Welcome to Dynasty As They Want to Be, a podcast where we drill into every episode of the iconic 1980s television series, Dynasty. I'm your host, Derek J. Lang, and with me is my co-host and loving, adoring husband, Kyler K. Jafari.
I am Adam Carrington, son of Alexis Colby Carrington.
Whoa, we're quoting the episode right off the bat. This was a very quotable episode.
Well, I don't know how quotable it was. That was certainly quotable. And that's sort of the beginning and the end of this episode for me.
I'm surprised that you're able to form words because prior
My
to...
My tongue is like numb right now, literally. I'm not even making that up.
What cat got your tongue? What has
no,
your
jalapeno
tongue?
Got my tongue.
Yeah, you made some delicious Bloody Marys for breakfast this morning, and you included a jalapeno garnish, which you decided
then we'll have a sensible dinner,
which you decided to eat. I don't know why a raw jalapeno.
Well, I didn't eat the whole thing. It was just the garnish that I made out of it. But really, I guess it's true. Jalapenos are hot. Derp. Today
spoiler alert. I mean, when you don't cook them, they are hotter. I thought you knew that.
I love spicy, so I went for it and didn't know what I was getting into.
I know. Well, we're both spicy.
Just like Alexis.
We're both spicy boys, so I'm surprised that it is affecting you throughout the day today.
Well, it does make me miss, you know, obviously everybody misses going out to a restaurant for a meal, but there's certain places that were already gone well before all of this. And I don't know how spicy it was, but you know, it was our favorite little Mexican joint down the street from our first apartment.
In West Hollywood.
And I don't even know that the food
That's
was that
right,
good.
Boys. We lived in West Hollywood.
Ugh, what a cliche. But it wasn't even like the food was great. It was about the atmosphere and the theatrics of it all. We need to pay remembrance to Gardens of Taxco, or
R.I.P.
I don't know how you pronounce that name, but that's probably how everybody in L.A. said it. It was something about, like, it wasn't terribly expensive, but you got this, like, amazing experience. And
it really was dinner theater.
It was. And it was like you would get this prefix menu, but you could choose your own adventure. There were like two or three different versions
and
of the
pretty groundbreaking,
and
because they didn't have paper menus or any kind of menus.
They were spoken menus.
I mean,
if
there
not
was
theatrically
no,
acted menus.
No QR code. But yeah, they just told you what they had.
Not hot. Spicy.
Yeah, the enchiladas were not hot. They were spicy.
Like it was as if they were
born in the sauce.
Yeah, I miss those kinds of things. I mean, I don't know. That's like almost from another world. That's what LA has turned into.
Well,
it's
and that's
going like
to be happening
anymore.
As we continue on. A lot of these restaurants aren't able to cut
it. I know, it's sad
it.
Because what's going on right now, things like that were barely hanging on by a thread are definitely going to be gone, or mostly anyway.
Yeah, the restaurant industry is already so hard to maintain in, and this has just put a lot. I mean, a lot of places I already know are out of business, and
well,
I think it's just going to continue to happen.
I think just in closing on Gardens of Taxco, there's no better restaurant review than as we were leaving and sitting in the waiting area while somebody paid our bill. This older woman in a jumpsuit is just saying, "Oh, this is such an exciting experience. I can't wait to take my boyfriend here." And then she says, "I need to have a big fat cigarette."
And
I don't
know
it's one of these moments that's like stuck with me forever.
And
like,
I know
not
what
like
you're thinking, listeners. No, it was not Liza. We're not going to name drop here, but she definitely was in the vein of Liza for sure. But yeah, this place is so campy.
I mean, we probably should have done this during our Acapulco episode, but you know,
I'm sure they're going to go back to Acapulco at some point, right?
Maybe. I feel like they're starting to run out of exotic locations, so possibly it'll
starting
go back
to
into
run
the rotation.
Out. Well, I know they go to space at some point. I know a lot of some of the bigger storylines just because they sort of eclipsed the show. For those of you that are new listeners, the way this kind of works is I've never seen Dynasty before. So we're watching it. We're going through all 9 seasons together. Kyler has seen most of the episodes. So obviously, like, I know a lot of things that happen on the show, even though I haven't told totally watched it. Like, you know, I know at this point, Jack Coleman is taking over the role of Stephen Carrington. And James Hong, we mentioned him in last week's episode, plays the plastic surgeon that transforms Stephen Carrington from Al Corley into Jack Coleman. And he's in the news this week. Daniel Day-Kim, who was on Lost and that like Hawaii Five-0 reboot. Anyway, he started a online petition fundraiser to get James Hong a star on the Walk of Fame. Anyway, I tweeted this out. I said, hey, I am here for it. Please give James Hong a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. And don't forget that he transformed Al Corley into Jack Coleman. And Jack Coleman responded on Twitter saying, simply, James Hong rocks.
Oh, it felt more enthusiastic. It felt more like a James Hong rocks.
James Hong rocks.
Wasn't it like all caps with 4 exclamation points or something?
No, correct proper name, capitalization, 1 exclamation point.
Oh, it's a legend in my own mind. But
what that now means is, according to my math, at least 2 Dynasty cast members know of the existence of this podcast. Unless he just wrote James Hong rocks.
They know of it. They don't listen or approve.
Yeah, Jack Coleman, if you're subscribed and you're listening to this, please tweet me.
You might want to turn it off because after the next episode, I don't know how I'm going to...
Ruh-roh. When them bandages come off.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we've been talking enough about this episode. I think we take a break and then we
actually talk
really
about
get
the
into
episode.
It.
Mm-hmm.
Darlings, today's installment of Dynasty As They Want to Be is brought to you by Audible. Kyler, you gotta get on Audible. They're offering a free audiobook with a 30-day trial membership. Just go to audibletrial.com/nastypodcast. That's NASTY podcast to browse their unrivaled selection of audio programs.
I've been currently listening to the September 1983 issue of Southern Living.
I don't think that's available on Audible. But
oh, yes, they've got everything.
It might be. I mean, they do have a lot. I know they have Diane Carroll's autobiography. They have some Jackie Collins books on there. You got to go check it out for yourself and just see what they have and what they don't have. Kyler, to get started, simply go to audibletrial.com/nastypodcast or text nastypodcast to 500-500.
NASTY.
Welcome back.
Well, this episode, the first couple times I watched it, I kind of wrote off the first 2 acts, and it was kind of just all about the ending scene for me.
Mm-hmm. It ends with some drama.
And it still kind of is about the ending scene. I mean, but that's a good way to kind of cap off what I now realize is a thoroughly good episode, although it maybe is not as good as some things that come before and after. I don't know. But anyway, the point is aesthetically speaking, this has got everything. It's got wife beating. It's got paint-fueled psychosis. It's got Cain and Abel destruction. It's got overwrought incidental music. I mean, what else could you ask for? And this is like why people thought this was a trashy show and still watched it anyway and secretly loved it at the time. And now, of course, we can just overtly love it, I guess.
It has everything. It has bumblebee jewelry, John James shirtless, double babies.
Double babies.
It's that thing where there's one nursery and there's 2 babies in the nursery and one of them's teething and crying the whole goddamn episode. I don't know what was more annoying. John James crying the whole episode in his continued paint-fueled rage the teething baby.
Yeah, what I was going to say about this episode ultimately boils down to 2 exciting and very pointed topics, which is primitive fuchsia. And teething.
My new drag name.
Teething. There's so much teething going on, but you know who's the real cranky baby?
The adults
is
are teething.
Jeff is a cranky fucking baby.
Oh, yeah. He's the biggest baby of them all. He's like a bigger baby than Blake now.
And I have thoughts on that, but anyway, we shall continue. But what I think really makes this episode is the primitive fuchsia of it all.
I used to like to write short stories about knights on white horses and dedicate it to Jeff. And the first time you ever wore makeup, I think you were 12, and Jeff's Little League game was rained out, so he finally came to one of Stephen's birthday parties. I was 11, and it was only lipstick, but it was the most grotesque shade you've ever seen, sort of this primitive fuchsia. Oh,
It is Kirby's awakening as a woman, as psychotherapized by Crystal. This is like maybe the one thing she's been given to do in the last three episodes. Like, because mostly
they
just
had one scene together. You're reading a lot into this. Please explain.
Well, I was about to until you rudely interrupted me. So Crystal, like, runs around in, you know, negligees and flowing nightgowns and brings the baby on like a tour of the house to admire the priceless objects. And
it's a Ming. Babies got to learn early about their Ming vases so they don't knock them over.
Yeah, this is like some MK Ultra. Like, she's gonna take the baby to rich people Illuminati town. But anyhow,
well, did you also, sorry to interrupt you again, but that's kind of what we do here. Did you notice we were introduced to a new room in the Carrington mansion that we had not previously seen before?
Well, I was on a discursive thought experiment there, but sure, yes, we went to the solarium. They've got budget now. They're adding budget and
for fake plants.
For the first time, it's not being spent on clothes. That we have a new room. It's the solarium. I don't know how that differs from the conservatory.
You're right. It's not a conservatory. It's a solarium.
If you've played Clue, like, you would like have to wonder. I thought a conservatory was a place for plants, but no.
Aren't
conservatory can actually be a place
there's
for
only like eight rooms in Clue. Carrington Mansion has over 40.
I think 43 on last count. I don't recall, but yeah,
Dr. Nick Toscani name checked it. I will have to go back and look at our notes, but there's way more rooms. And so now it makes sense to me why the conservatory doesn't have plants, because they have a solarium.
Well, because this is the kind of conservatory that's basically a sitting room with a piano in it. So
it's for smoking.
Musical instruments and brandy and smoking, I guess.
I think you're
not
supposed to smoke in the library. You can smoke in the conservatory. And the solarium, you can just sniff.
Well, it's that very, like, Victorian idea that you had a smoking room so that you wouldn't stink up the whole house. Like, mm-hmm. Just one room for the gents to smoke their horse turds. Anyway. So Alexis with the presents in the solarium. I mean, we're wrapping presents in Mylar, shiny foil things.
Love.
More superficiality. I think the show is finally just acknowledging how superficial it's about to become.
I mean, Alexis says herself she doesn't want to open one of the presents because she'll break a nail.
Right. I think Crystal kind of has a quip to return on that. And
I don't know. It's a valid concern, if you ask me.
It's basically like everybody kind of like subtextually acknowledging how this is really just becoming about clothes and sets and the cinematography. But meanwhile, the story writing is kind of thin.
Oh, I disagree about that, because I think we get a huge revelation in this episode. And that's really what Adam Carrington, I guess, has been working towards with this damn makeover.
Well, that's actually the only, and that's why I thought the third act originally was the only thing that was a saving grace of this episode. And then having watched it three or four more times, it kind of all is a slow build. But I think Adam's thread is kind of the only real true storytelling that's salvageable in this episode, and that's not in a bad way. It just kind of is.
Yeah,
is,
I mean, I agree there's not like real big payoffs in this episode, but we're definitely moving things along. We're not getting stagnant. A lot of these storylines are developing. But yeah, I think for the most part, this episode is John James running around screaming, whining at the children, at Fallon, at Mark Jennings, even at Crystal. He has a nasty thing to say to her at the breakfast table.
Well, you just said it, Crystal. I collapsed from overwork. Burnout, isn't that what it's called?
Have you been back to see Dr. Winfield since that night? Have you?
My God, what is it with you women? My son is sick and you tell me he doesn't need a doctor. I'm not sick and you tell me I do. Doesn't anybody in this house think straight anymore?
I think that his real madness is not the paint in the walls. It's he's been, I don't know.
Conditioned.
Truthed. He's decided that he's a Republican now, and he's basically become a wife beater. And he says to...
Okay, are we going to just go straight to the wife beating? You've mentioned it a couple times here. I don't think that was really him. I think he's been emotionally distressed. His brain chemistry has been altered.
Well, I think he's been watching a lot of Fox News. And he Jeff can't handle working mom power.
Well, he is hanging
out. He's got a real issue with Fallon, and he goes total Republican. And she's not a bad wife and mother. He says that she is.
It is true that he's
always... But she's a bad wife and mother for old paradigms.
Right. He always has had an issue with her working.
Yeah.
Like, from the very...
And this is a struggle we go through in the 80s. Like, you know, women are no longer content to be housewives. But this is what Jeff's going through. He can't handle it. Which normally we would think, oh, he's a... You know, a woke, yuppie.
Oh, I would have never described him as woke. Are you fucking kidding me?
Well, scrap all of that.
I think what you're saying, and I'm starting to come over to your side, is that these feelings have always been there, simmering underneath. And the paint fumes have just dissipated.
He was fine to put up with it for a little bit. Mm-hmm. And then one day he listened to a little too much AM talk radio in his Mercedes 420 SEL.
And he snapped.
Yeah.
It's pretty bad. Mark Jennings is more woke than Jeff Colby. We have another instance of Mark Jennings coming to save the day right after he's done having some more afternoon delight with Alexis, which I do appreciate. This is a purely sexual relationship between the two of them. They've firmly established that now.
Well, Mark's been busy this whole episode casting pearls before swine. I mean, Fallon doesn't want his jewels from Jensen's, and really neither does Alexis. I mean, she humors him.
With his little insect pendant.
And we get a nice little bit of like weird stunt hands. I mean, maybe it was their hands, but it was bad hand acting.
Yeah.
Hammy hand acting.
I think it has to do with how big the cameras were back then. But anytime there's like a hand reaching from out of frame, it always looks...
It just looks uncanny.
Yeah.
Wooden.
It looks like it's mannequin hands or something. But yeah, they have a purely sexual relationship and have some more... champagne upstairs, and then he goes back to his place at La Mirage and notices Jeff, you know, strangling Fallon.
Let go of me.
Say it. I'm Fallon Carrington Colby, and I'm no good.
Let go of me.
Say it. My brother Stephen was right when he called me a $1 million tramp, because I am one. Stop. I'm rotten as a person, and I'm worse as a wife and a mother. Say it.
Stop it.
Say it.
So we have to talk about this goddamn intro at La Mirage. There's always this establishing shot.
I know. We laugh about it every week.
We laugh about it every week, and we laughed about it this time, too.
So basically what we've noticed, and maybe you have, too, is that they keep using the same B-roll, the exterior shot of La Mirage, and there is a woman wearing an orange Diane von Furstenberg dress.
It's like a sarong wrap dress thing.
And then there's another couple on their way to the tennis court, and they're always there. Always walking.
And it's always like the same 1978 brown Cadillac Coupe de Ville pulling up.
And considering that like 35% of the episodes take place at La Mirage, we're seeing this shot over and over again. They could have at least like spliced in like three or four.
But this all reinforces my theory about La Mirage as purgatory, because it's... You just go back and around in circles, and it never really evolves, and it's always the same thing, and... I love that feeling of being trapped there.
Okay, know? David Lynch. Let's talk about the baby, specifically Danny, and what's going on with the new parents. Isn't this really bizarre that the grandparents are adopting the baby? And it seems like they're kind of treating it like their own.
Well,
I'm skeeved out.
This is my own sort of theory, is that we're all being set up for a bunch of imposters, and the main one certainly right now is Stephen Carrington, and now we've got parents who are imposters to the baby.
Well, and the baby could be
surrogacy.
An imposter too, because I still haven't seen a DNA test on that one, but whatever.
You want to see it ever see?
Yeah, I guess there's going to be complications with the Carringtons adopting Danny, Sammy Joe's baby, because the divorce between Crystal and
Mark,
or as
Alexis refers to her, that garbage niece.
Yes, garbage niece. Hashtag primitive fuchsia. Hashtag garbage niece. But yeah, I guess like this divorce still isn't settled. They made it seem like it was going to be so easy. So now I feel like they're just stringing it along to complicate matters.
We have like the fake marriage of Blake and Crystal, which I feel like it's been fake all along, so that's fine. I mean, the thing about Crystal is she doesn't really ever have anything to do, and that's why I thought it was interesting.
That's why she's wearing negligees at 11:30
a.m.
in the a.m.
But you know, Blake's calling her up for a lunch date. Like, we all know that at this time, this is pre-COVID, you should be full dressed by 8 a.m. because you've got to set an example for the help. I mean, God forbid they serve your grapefruit to you and you're not in a suit and tie.
Now, going back to the solarium, this is where Alexis learns that they're adopting the baby. At least that's the plan because of all of this botched Mexican divorce procedures. But Alexis has like a secret witch power or something. It seems like she materializes. She goes straight from the solarium
to
the top of Denver Carrington and confronts Blake, and she's pissed. And I don't think she wants the baby. She just wants to one-up Blake.
I like that she's wearing yellow in that scene because it really suggests lightning and, like, I'm going to take action and I'm a powerful, pissed-off woman.
Yeah, it's definitely an energetic color, that's for sure.
What was that thing that Blake was eating at La Mirage for lunch with
I think
Crystal?
It was a chili cheese dog.
I thought it was a Dodger dog something like that, or maybe it was a Polska kielbasa with lots and lots of hot stuff.
The food on the show always looks so disgusting. I mean, Crystal's just eating a salad, I think, but like all the vegetables have those weird cuts in them, so you know somebody's fingers have just been all over it as they sculpt her cucumber. I mean, maybe it's like a stick of garlic bread or something. I don't know. Looks like a big old wiener inside of a bun.
The topic, if you move on from teething, because everybody's teething, especially Jeff, this whole frigging episode, which is just to say that they're all just cranky and not really sure why. The topic is primitive fuchsia. The password is primitive fuchsia.
Coming to the stage, primitive fuchsia.
Primitive fuchsia is the color of my true love's hair.
Primitive fuchsia, Shantae, you stay.
So anyway, I love that Kirby has this sort of sit down and wake up moment with Crystal in the nursery with the primitive fuchsia lipstick that she, you know, Crystal's like, tell me about the first time that you ever wore makeup.
Well, I just love that Crystal's calling Kirby out. She's like, yeah, you want to fuck Jeff.
Yeah, you want to. Yeah, exactly.
Everybody knows you want to fuck Jeff.
We already knew this from at least 12 episodes back. We've been knowing.
Oh my
this,
God. As soon as she got out of the taxi cab,
the first
Paris,
thing she
I
did
she
was like, go
fuck
sniff
Jeff.
Jeff's panties. Yeah. So the thing is,
and then she seems so demure, like, oh, you know about that.
She compares her first time wearing makeup, primitive fuchsia. So that's an interesting usage because primitive kind of refers to primordial, the first time, the evolution from the things which begat. So it's this sort of like Greek tragedy device. And I love it because it comes back in the end scene with Alexis. She's in fuchsia lipstick, which Kirby had described earlier in reference to discovering her own womanhood. And I don't think that the writers and the costume or makeup department got together and, you know, coerced.
I don't
this.
Know. They were thinking about a lot of things and
maybe
telling that story.
I don't want to give them too much credit, though, because I feel like this show is a little bit
slipshod.
They deserve
it. Give them all
the show
credit.
Under the microscope, it gets a bit off. But if you pull back, sure, maybe. And I love Alexis just being psychologically blackmailed by Adam. And I think this is finally like Adam getting his due, because up to this point, he's just sort of, I wouldn't say one note, but he hadn't really been fully evolved.
Yeah.
And now I'm like fully liking this character.
Think of it, Mother. How would it feel to run the Colby Empire from a prison cell?
God, I don't believe what I'm hearing. What kind of a monster are you?
I am Adam Carrington, son of Alexis Carrington Colby. Consider the options, Mother. You don't have any.
I do like that we're given a plan here. He was thinking beyond just trying to piss off Jeff with this poisonous paint, that there was a grand plan.
Yeah.
And I was shocked that he actually let Alexis in on it. But I think that's just the nature of storytelling.
So I think it just, that little piece starts with Adam going around to Blake's office, to Jeff's office, and then winding up at Alexis's penthouse. It's all of his plotting and shit stirring. And Alexis has done this already. We've seen her do this in this show, but she doesn't always it doesn't always work out for her.
Mm-hmm.
It blows up in her face as much as it does not.
Well, and she usually has three or four plans going on at the same time.
Yeah, she likes to spin blades.
Where it seems like
Adam's been focused.
Focused, other than, you know, when he raped Kirby, he's been completely focused on this.
Well, and I think that's probably part of the larger reason why it's very easy to dislike him, at least in the beginning here, because that's not very palatable. But here's the thing. In the end, Adam here is not like Alexis because he is getting what he sought out to achieve. I think the reason that he actually reveals to Alexis, I think he had his hand called early. I think he was already plotting this in the background, but I think he was forced to reveal to Alexis because
she seems set that she was going to take over that office.
Well, it wasn't even just take over the office. It's that he can't let her go into that room because he knows that she's going to be under the influence of the pain fumes.
Oh, yeah. And she's like the biggest... She's the queen on the chessboard, so he can't lose her to dementia or whatever.
Right. One is pressed to answer, is he good or bad? And obviously he's a little bit of both, probably mostly bad. I don't know, but that's kind of why we like this character, I think.
Well,
but
a good
he's not going to let his mother endanger her mental health.
Right.
And so that's why he's kind of forced to reveal this. But I think he was already kind of going to back her into a corner at some point. This is just how it turned out.
A good villain has to have shades of gray, right? And they have to have weaknesses. They have to have things they actually care about. Otherwise, it's one note and it's boring. And between his mother and his father, who he just met for the first time earlier this year, he loves his mom because his dad has kind of done him dirty and treated him like shit and didn't believe him. And his mom was there for them and put him in charge at the top of this huge oil company, which... Did you notice we got a little taste of letterhead on the memo that Adam sent?
Yeah, that Colbico letterhead was fire.
Oh my God, that logo would, it's iconic. But did you notice that the address
for... You could wear that today.
The address for Colbico is 100 Colby Plaza. So they have their own...
Oh, they bought it all up.
Freaking plaza.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They bought off a local councilman or something.
Yeah, well, so it makes sense why they have a whole spinoff named after them, but, you know. TBD on that. I think this episode did a lot of justice for Adam, even though his crazy plot was revealed. I think he's a more fleshed out villain. I think he's going places. And I think it did something for Alexis too, because we see where her line is. She's not going to endanger people. Although she did cause Crystal to have a miscarriage when she fired that gun.
Oh, we've forgotten about that. This is soap opera logic.
I guess unborn babies are fair game, but... 30-something-year-old young oil execs or not.
Otherwise, you have a baby that's teething. I mean, you know, either way, there's problems. So I just think that in the end, this final scene is...
Operatic.
It is opera. It's not even soap operatic. It is opera. It is functioning off Greek tragedy. We are telling stories in the fewest words possible and the most images available. I love it. I love it.
Very inspired for them to start on a close-up. You know, the whole scene mm-hmm. between the three of them that were up in the penthouse had been played pretty closely, which it normally is. And then you get that last shot close on Alexis, and then it kind of zooms out when she realizes that her oldest son is a fucking psycho and is trying
She's
to
created
merge
a monster.
These two companies. Yeah, yeah, it's Frankenstein, really.
Yeah, it's Alexis's monster. And, you know, there she is in her fuchsia lipstick as she plops defeated onto the couch and the credits roll. It's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And this episode's a little bit strange, but I think it bears a lot of fruit, and I'm there for it.
Yeah, don't get mad about it.
Get bout about it.
Now it's time for the part of the episode where we choose our lurks of the week. Is there really a choice here? There was one.
I know which one you're
really
going for.
Amazing.
I know which
outfit.
One you're going for. Just say it.
No, you say it. Man, if you're reading my mind.
Just say it.
No, say if you think you know, you say it.
No, because I have the one that you don't have. So you just say yours.
Obviously, it's the yellow and black that Alexis is buzzing around Denver in.
Black and yellow, black and yellow.
Black and yellow. And yellow.
Yeah, you know what it is.
Yeah, I mean, the silhouette, the fabrics, the cut isn't that great, but just the fact that she's bold enough to wear black and yellow with a little fur, too.
Well, this is a journey into, you know, proper 1980s. We're finally getting to a moment here in this show that's presaging how 80s everything was about to become.
Oh, honey, we've yellow been was getting a primary there. Color. Remember last week?
Nobody we had was that wearing primary colors in the 70s.
Right. Mm-hmm. At least not like women in their
and framed with black 30s, early you know 40s. Black is the accent color. Black and white were so important in the 80s because they offset all the primary colors. And you're right, what is this weird black foxtails thing that she's wearing? Does it even come in black? Did they dye it black? I don't know. Nolan Miller's got a $20,000 check every episode to write for this stuff, so fine. Yeah, and you know, again, it's the hat. She's not wearing primitive fuchsia. She's wearing red lipstick and, you know, proper accented eye makeup. So it's all a total look again, and it's super 1980s, but it's a little bit ahead of its time. I mean, at this point, the country's still a little bit in a recession. So she Whoa. Went to Bergdorf's and
Alexis Carrington Colby is not in a recession.
She don't care. Yeah. Well, my look of the week, and it's a little bit for cultural reasons and a little bit for aesthetic reasons, but it's most certainly Pamela Sue Martin in the Southwestern dress.
Oh,
like
yeah.
With the teal blouse and the camel colored suede.
Another selection
suede
from the
skirt.
Stevie Nicks collection.
It's a little bit Stevie. It was a little bit colorful for Stevie Nicks, though. I think Stevie Nicks sticks to her palette, you know. But it is this. I remember my mother, like when I was like, we had this coffee table book called Southwest Style, I think. And it was that was very much a young-ish way to decorate. And here Fallon's bringing it, like she's wearing it. It's all just like this very Southwest turquoise and silver and feathers and beads kind of look. And this is all how Fallon like did her own thing fashion wise. But a lot of that, of course, is her age. But some of it too is that I think that is the character's perspective. So
I mean, I appreciate that there's more of a perspective, but I wish it was explained. Maybe she went to college at ASU or she spent a summer in Sedona or something, but it just kind of comes out of nowhere. And then it clashes with everything that the older ladies on the show are wearing. And then, like, sometimes in this episode, she has that when she's wearing that red outfit that she gets choked in, not in a good way. It seems like, you know, maybe her mom bought her that or something. So I don't know. Her fashion sense is always all over the place to me.
Yeah, that's why it's, you know, it's a troubling look, but I think it says something very different from the rest of the show. And I think it's an important thing to call out because that whole Southwestern idea was so prevalent later in the 80s. And, you know, again, this is kind of ahead of it.
Well, look, at least she's not wearing a negligee at 11:30 a.m. on a weekday. Well, that's another edition of Dynasty as They Want to Be. Kyler, thank you so much for joining me. You know, you really are a million-dollar tramp.
My name is Victoria Winters.
Wrong show. If you want to follow along with us between episodes, go to any social media account and follow Nasty Podcast. That's NASTY. Podcast. Dynasty is like a sports term now, so that's why we don't have it in our title. We're just nasty.
We're so nasty.
And we have a Patreon if you want access to ad-free episodes, exclusive bonus episodes, and other polls and fun content. Go to patreon.com/nastypodcast. Kyler, it's always good to see you. Martini?
Okay.